Thanks for listening to Here and Now. We want to know about your experience listening to this podcast, what you like and don't like. If you have suggestions or feedback, send us an email at hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's news out of Milwaukee today that Christopher Manny will not be charged in the fatal shooting of a young black man sleeping in a park. Manny had been fired for violating police procedures, but again, he will not be charged.
And of course, this comes after this weekend's targeted killings of two police officers in a planned attack that the attacker says was motivated by the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner at the hands of police. NYPD union leaders are openly criticizing Mayor Bill de Blasio for earlier sympathizing with protesters. Here's Precinct Council President Juan Rodriguez.
Mr. Mayor, you need to have a sit down, and you need to get everything corrected from the mayor's office down, because this is wrong. We need you to work with the community and the police department. We don't need you to just go to one side. The police department needs you as well.
Joining us now is Eugene O'Donnell. He's a former New York City police officer and now lectures at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice at the City University of New York. Eugene, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
And also with us is Khalil Gibran Muhammad, director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library. He's author of The Condemnation of Blackness. Khalil, welcome back to you, too.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
And Eugene O'Donnell, I want to start with you. Do you think that this was just a deranged individual, or do you agree with people who say that there's blood on the hands of people at City Hall because of sympathy with protesters following Ferguson?
I think there's two conversations, mental health and guns. And then there's a conversation that I don't necessarily think is a good week, at least in my town, to have, which is, yes, there were some underlying issues about things said about the police, particularly about NYPD, that were simply not true. I think that elected officials generally have played a not good role, particularly lawmakers, even more than executives, in failing to embrace the system they own and operate. They're the architects of, they're the partners with the police of, the bashing of the police that has gone on without any context. Failure to explain what the grand jury does, failure to explain the lawmakers that give the police the broad powers that they have. Some of the militarization stuff, when this is all over in New York, I think we need to get back on that, because it turns out that most of what's called militarization is actually equipment that's used not for any actual offensive purpose. It's used defensively and also in things like floods and hurricanes. And elected officials, by the way, across the political spectrum, took some very cheap shots at the police this summer.
But I've gone back and looked at, because people have been blaming Mayor de Blasio, I went back and looked at his press conference from right after the Eric Garner decision, in which he talked about his son Dante, and who's biracial, and how they had to train Dante to be careful in interactions with police officers when he was young. But he does, over and over again, reiterate the fact that he has respect for the police, that we should all respect the police. That doesn't seem like it was enough for certain people in New York. Was it enough for you, or are you saying that he is one of the people who's been taking shots at the police?
No, I think that there's obviously a legitimate issue that needs to be had about race relations and the police and the legacy issues. So what I take strenuous objection to is the idea that we blame individual street officers for systematic failures. Staten Island, New York, which was one of the issues here, that was completely really at the hands of the leadership, who failed to say a police officer in the street shouldn't have to make an arrest for somebody selling loose cigarettes. By the way, I've yet to really hear any political leaders who said stop doing that or find another way to do it. It seems that in the absence of solving some of the big problems, the whole conversation seems to be about $45,000 a year patrolman Darren Wilson and, you know, individual street officers in New York City. I find that kind of unseemly, actually.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad, how do you look at all of this, and how do you respond to what we've just heard?
Well, I think that for me, we should start with Mr. Brinsley, the person who executed two innocent people who are members of the NYPD. From what we know in these initial days of reporting, this just happened, and I think we have a lot to learn. He does strike me as a deranged person. He has a history of mental illness. He attempted to hang himself, according to the New York Times, a year ago. So when I look at this, I compare it much more, it looks much more like the kind of both mental illness culture blending with gun violence and, to a degree, anti-government activism. One of the police officials in the NYPD have analyzed his Instagram account and noted that a lot of the profile that he presents is someone who is taking issue with the government. So I think we all have to kind of step back and look at the broader context in which Mr. Brinsley's shooting took place, and I'm not sure that it is a reflection on Mr. de Blasio's comments about what happened in the Garner case and the conditions that his son may face, which are very real for tens of thousands of young people in New York City.
What do you think this does, though, to the movement that had started up around the country following Ferguson?
Well, I think that it's going to make it harder for protesters and demonstrators to exercise their First Amendment rights. There's going to be a reevaluation of how police officers essentially control protesters and the crowds. That's unfortunate because I don't think that there's any evidence that anyone sent out Mr. Brinsley to do this. And certainly from the reporting and the observations that I've made of the many demonstrations since Ferguson, most people are not only committed to nonviolence, but they're committed to community and police relationships that would support peace on both sides of the blue line.
Eugene, what do you think as we move forward now after the terrible event over the weekend? What happens to that movement that had been really growing with protests around the country of people who wanted a different relationship between the community and the police than exists today, at least for people of color?
Well, you know, Khalil made a really good point there, and I hope people will see that this is not an ideological slugfest where we're all trying to score points. You know, it would be a sin if protest did not go on that's legitimate and change did not go on. The one thing everybody can agree on, and I tell you this, that the cops can agree with this also, is we have a brutal and broken criminal justice system, and that the reforms there should go full speed ahead. What should not happen, I think, and has happened and needs to be recentered, is what I have seen is a basic attack on street officers who are out there doing the job and are doing the best they can, and are working class people who who actually counterintuitively don't have really any power in their workplace, as some might think. And we have to acknowledge the best idealistic cop will have to tell you that, yes, I work in a system that has a vestige of racism in it, and that a lot of these laws are racially unfair. And again, but I would like to also see elected officials come up with solutions to that. And we also can't oversimplify it. This is a guy, whether he should have been psychiatrically locked up or criminal justice-wise locked up, should not have been out in the streets to shoot this woman and kill these police officers.
That's Eugene O'Donnell, a former New York City police officer who now lectures at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice at the City University of New York. And we've also been joined by Khalil Gibran Muhammad, director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library. Guys, thanks to both of you.
Sure. Thank you very much.
In Tunisia today, the Election Commission declared Beji Caid Essebsi the winner of that country's first free presidential election. He'd been part of Tunisia's leadership since the revolution there in 2011 that started the Arab Spring. But while Tunisia takes an important step toward democracy, another Arab Spring country could be backsliding. The BBC's Orla Guerin reports.
Downtown Cairo. Crowds gather near Tahrir Square, cradle of the revolution. Their demands the same now as they were then.
We need freedom! We look for freedom!
They came to protest after a court dropped criminal charges against Hosni Mubarak. The security forces moved in with tear gas and birdshot. Two protesters were killed. The regime is waging war on dissent. The young activist Asma Mahfouz was hoping for a different outcome when she recorded this video in January 2011. She called for Egyptians to join her in Tahrir Square, an appeal that helped spark the uprising.
Hey, yeah.
These days, Asma is the mother of an infant daughter and a target for the authorities. She was recently banned from leaving the country.
Three or four years on, we're in a much worse situation than before. This is a regime that crushes anyone who opposes it or even thinks of opposing it. The regime is hostile towards the revolution, and it's trying to erase it from history.
Oh, this is Ara as a teenager.
Across town, mathematics professor Laila Suaif shows me pictures of her son, Alaa Abdel Fattah, another icon of the revolution. He's in jail for demonstrating, as is his sister Sanaa. Laila, an activist since the 70s, says rage is building among the young and it will erupt.
You cannot keep down 10 million young people. You cannot do that. I predict another uprising, whether it's going to be a revolution or just an uprising that burns down the country, that's a different question.
For now, those who dare to challenge the state are in the firing line. First the Islamists, then the liberals, now human rights groups. Staff at the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights gather for what could be one of their last meetings. A vague new law on foreign funding means they could face life in prison. Director Khaled Mansour says the environment has never been more sinister.
They want to control the activities, and controlling funding is just an entry point for them to control our activities. So they can come and say, oh, you cannot work on torture now. We are on a war in terror. So you can't work on that. You can't work on this because this will undermine public peace. What is public peace? They will never tell you what is public peace. For them, public peace is public silence.
Well, I'm now at the Interior Ministry. I've come to meet the Assistant Minister for Human Rights, General Aboubakar Abdel Karim. I want to get the government's response to the allegation that there's more repression here now than ever.
The state is rebuilding itself and restoring the confidence of citizens and has written a constitution that stresses many freedoms. If it's trying to be a police state, it wouldn't have done all this.
The BBC's Orla Guerin in Egypt. This is Here and Now. Over the holidays, there's a good chance you'll gather with family. What's the last thing you want to talk about? Less popular than politics or money. How about end of life? Award-winning journalist Ellen Goodman wants to change that. She's the founder of The Conversation Project. Since she launched her website 2 years ago, more than 150,000 people from all 50 states and 125 countries have downloaded a kit to start a conversation. When we spoke with Ellen last year, we asked her, how did this idea during such a festive holiday come to her?
I know you, what you're thinking. You're thinking, yeah, Merry Christmas and let's talk about death.
Right.
But in fact, these are some of the most intimate conversations that people have. And it turns out that they're not scary. In fact, when people do gather together as a family, they tell family stories. And if there's one story that every family has, it's about a good death or a hard death. And that's the way to open up this conversation, because we know we have to have these conversations.
Well, and you know about hard deaths. You lost your own mom, and this grew out of that.
It did. I started thinking about this when my own mother was dying, because my mother and I had talked about everything. I used to say that she was a person who could talk about your problems until you were bored with them. But we had never talked about what she wanted as she went through the end of life. I mean, we hadn't talked about anything more than her saying, you know, if I'm ever like that, pointing to something, pull the plug. Mm-hmm. And of course, at the end of life, there was no plug to pull. But yeah. I was faced with a kind of cascading number of decisions for which I was unprepared and blindsided.
Yeah, a lot of us are familiar with that. My mom fell. And I've shared this before. I remember going into the little consultation room with a bunch of doctors who looked really on edge and angry. And she was very elderly, and they explained that she'd have to have this deep brain surgery and all this work that would have to be done. I said, oh, I don't think we want to do that to her. And they were so relieved. But I had to sort of make that, as you say, that was not a plug to be pulled.
That's right. And if you're lucky, and we want to make sure it's more than luck, you've had these conversations early before there's a crisis. You're talking about running into a crisis, or you're talking about people who end up making these decisions in the ICU. This is not the place to talk about what matters to you, what your values are, to have a real conversation about the kind of care that you want and the kind of care that you don't want. Yeah. So we want to bring these talks early.
Well, and by the way, she was already sliding into a form of dementia, so I couldn't have had it with her. I couldn't ask her at that point. Well, give us some of the stats that convince you that there's a disconnect here about what people want, but what they're apparently not expressing.
Well, there are some pretty simple ones. 70% of people in America say they want to die at home, and 70% of people are dying in hospitals and institutions. And maybe at home is not just a place, but it's an idea of how you want to die, surrounded by people you love, in comfort, not in an ICU, not tied up to a ventilator. At the same time, we also had a survey that the Conversation Project did that showed that 90% of Americans know that it's important to have these conversations, but only 30% have had them.
There's another stat. 82% of people say it's important to put their wishes in writing. Only 23% do that.
So there are these huge disconnections. We know what we should be doing. We tend to think it's too soon. That's our excuse, you know. And as we say at the Conversation Project, it's always too soon until it's too late.
Well, and it's too unbearable in some cases. You don't want to think about a loved one's end, especially at Christmas, as you said.
Well, it's funny because there are, between adult children and elderly parents, there are sort of, there's a kind of conspiracy of silence often. The adult child doesn't want to even suggest to the parent that they might be dying or they might ever die, I should say. And the elderly parent doesn't want to worry the child. And so each of us sits there knowing. I mean, my favorite line comes from The Onion magazine, which had a wonderful headline a couple of years ago that said, "Death rate holds steady at 100%. You know, we all know the deal here. And when we don't talk about it, we end up often feeling quite lonely and isolated.
Well, how do you move it beyond, I don't want to end like that? You've got some tools at the Conversation Project website, some sentences that just begin the conversation.
That's right. The Conversation Project has a number of tools, the most popular of which has been the Conversation Starter Kit. And that Conversation Starter Kit is not, you know, if my left elbow and my right eyebrow are gone, stop care. It's much more what matters to you than what's the matter with you. It asks you, are you a person who wants to make all the decisions, or do you want to leave it in the hands of your doctor? Who among the people you love do you want to help make those decisions? What matters to you? Does it matter to you more being at home or not? Are you a person who wants every fact, every single piece of information, or do you believe that ignorance is bliss, you know? And we suggest often that probably one of the best ways for adult children to start these conversations with their elderly parents is to say, hey, I need some help. What if I'm left to make these decisions? It's the rare parent who can resist a child's request for help.
For help, because you're empowering them.
Yeah, and also, it's true. Yeah. You may need their help. You may want to know. We don't want people to end up the way they are now. Very often, our project is as much about survivors and families as about a, quote, good death.
Well, there does seem to be a cultural change. There are death dinners, death cafes. People come together to talk about dying, a number of TV documentaries. So there does seem to be a shift in the culture, no?
I think there is. I think we are at a tipping point. Part of it is that the baby boom generation is getting older, and we've been the change agents in our culture. We're the generation that changed the way we give birth in America, so maybe we'll be the generation that changes the way we die. I do think there is something of a cultural shift in it. That doesn't mean it's an easy one.
That's Ellen Goodman, founder of the Conversation Project, in our conversation last year. This year, the project is teaming up with the group Death Over Dinner, another organization urging end-of-life conversations. And they've both picked the first week of January to encourage people to make dates, to break bread, eat comfort food, and have those tough conversations about how they'd like to live the final days of their lives. And also in January, the two groups will release an e-cookbook called The Endless Table with recipes from the departed loved ones of famous foodies, including Ina Garten, Jasper White, and Legal Seafood CEO Roger Berkowitz. For more, you can go to herenow.org. We want to give big props to the state of Utah. For the 9th year in a row, Utahns are number one in terms of volunteering. The annual Volunteering and Civic Life in America report put out by the federal government found that close to 45% of Utahns volunteer, and they contribute about 155 million hours of service. There's a bit of an asterisk. Across the country, religious organizations are the biggest beneficiaries of volunteer work. They get about a third of the hours donated. But some point out that Utah has a huge Mormon church presence, but that sounds like sour grapes to us. Utah is joined at the top of the list by Idaho, Minnesota, Kansas, and Wisconsin in fundraising for nonprofits or distributing food, volunteer teaching, and coaching. The bottom of the list, Florida, Nevada, New York, Louisiana. As a native New Yorker, I'm not proud of that. For a link to see how your state did, go to hereandnow.org.
Arizona's Motor Vehicles Division is now open to so-called Dreamers. Starting today, immigrants who qualify for the Obama administration's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, can get driver's licenses in Arizona. The state's governor had banned licensing these young people, but a Ninth Circuit court ordered the state to issue the licenses, as 48 other states are already doing. Jude Joffe Block is a reporter with KJZZ in Phoenix, part of the Here and Now Contributors Network. And Jude, I know you've been down at the DMV, or the state's equivalent of the DMV, this morning. What's the scene there?
Yeah, there were a number of these young immigrants who qualified for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals in line this morning at the location I went to. Officials are saying that it's been a little busier than normal at offices around the state. One of the people I spoke with was 24-year-old Reyna Montoya. She was brought here illegally as a child. She's since gotten her work permit through the Obama administration program. She's now a high school teacher and has to drive to work. So she says she's been waiting through this 2-year legal battle to get her license. But even before that, she says she's really been waiting for this moment since she was 16 years old. Let's take a listen.
I mean, like, it's been what now? 8 years since then? So I'm just so excited. I'm just, at this moment, I'm just praying that I pass the test, because I think I would be really disappointed if I don't, because I've been studying so long.
And so Reyna actually has been studying, not even knowing when or if it would become legal for her to drive in Arizona. So today it paid off.
And how many people does this policy affect there in Arizona?
So there's more than 20,000 young immigrants in Arizona who could get licenses now. But keep in mind, this policy change isn't necessarily a done deal. Governor Jan Brewer is very upset that the federal appeals court is forcing the state to process these licenses. She says she wants the U.S. Supreme Court to review the case, but it's going to still be a number of months before we even know if the U.S. Supreme Court will take the case or what they'll say about it. So in the meantime, the state does have to issue these licenses.
And where does this leave the state of Arizona's immigration laws, which, as we know, are considered to be among the strictest in the country?
Yeah, so Arizona was actually known as a laboratory for state-led immigration policies. So there were drafters of these bills who were trying to test, you know, what kinds of policies would survive in the courts. And SB 1070 got a lot of attention, but there were a lot of other bills as well that were all part of this same experiment, really. And recently we've been seeing more of those laws getting struck down. That includes a state law that criminalized human smuggling. There was another one that denied bail to undocumented immigrants charged with certain crimes. And here in Maricopa County, our Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who once had a national profile on anti-illegal immigration issues, he's under supervision of a court-appointed monitor now, and that's because a federal judge decided he was racially profiling as part of his immigration enforcement tactics. And recently, the sheriff just announced he'd stop using one of his trademark tactics, which was arresting immigrants at work sites for using fake IDs.
So perhaps Arizona no longer deserves a reputation as a state that is on the forefront of taking a stand against illegal immigration?
Well, it's a really good question, because a lot of the laws that gave us that reputation are no longer in place. There's a few that remain, but those continue to be challenged. But, you know, it really depends how much that's going to translate to the climate on the ground in terms of how people think and feel about immigration issues. That still remains to be seen.
All right. Jude Joffe Block, reporter with KJZZ in Phoenix, part of the Here and Now Contributors Network, on this day when immigrants who qualify for the DACA plan can get their driver's licenses in Arizona. Jude, thanks.
Thank you.
The Indianapolis Star is raising some red flags about the booming industry of pet medications. In a three-part series, the newspaper found an industry that produces drugs with higher risk of unforeseen side effects than the human drug industry, and one that sometimes pays veterinarians to prescribe drugs. Indianapolis Star investigative reporter John Russell joins us from the NPR station WFYI in Indianapolis. And John, you tell the story of Sesame, a dog that its owner says was perfectly healthy until it went on a flea and heartworm drug called Trifexis. And within days, the dog had a seizure and collapsed?
Yes. And the thing about this dog was its owner is a surgeon, an orthopedic surgeon, an MD, who went through this long process of trying to figure out what killed his dog. Was it any kind of food problem? Was it any kind of behavioral problem, a gastrointestinal issue? And he ruled these things out one by one and basically gave up trying to figure out what killed his big, healthy dog until he ran across a group on the internet which had been posting about similar problems all over the country involving other dogs that had taken the same medication. And from there, he saw a pattern which he believed pointed to Trifexis being the cause of the dog's demise. So that's the story we focused in on to get a window into the pet medication industry. It's a $7 billion industry that we found out was very much underregulated compared to the world of human medicines. Veterinarians are a key player. They prescribe, not only prescribe, but they sell the medications, unlike most physicians, for human drugs. And if your dog or cat dies as a result of a drug or as a result of malpractice or abuse or neglect, you're not going to get anything out of it because the laws in most states say the dog's worth is only replacement value, which is $50 or $100.
Well, and of course, for dog owners, you can't put a price on it. Look, what does Elanco, the maker of Trifexis, say?
Yes, they're pretty insistent that Trifexis is completely safe. They said it's been thoroughly tested. It's been on the market and sold 70 million doses through 15,000 vets all around the country, and that the rate of deaths is extremely low. So they're standing by the drug. The FDA is saying that they've got no reason to believe that there's a problem with this drug, although they won't confirm if they've got a big investigation going.
But what did you find out about, you know, what to believe? Because you presume that medications, whether they're for animals or humans, are thoroughly vetted and tested. When mm-hmm. you say that meds for pets are not tested as highly as meds for humans are, what do you mean? I mean, how are they tested?
A normal human drug, experimental drug that's going through testing, is often tested on 5,000 to 10,000 people from beginning to end over a course of, it could be a decade for the whole development of the drug. Animal drugs are tested only on usually 200 or 300 cats or dogs, and they're often launched in a very quick time, 5 or 6 years compared to 10 or 12 years it can take for a new human drug to be developed.
Well, but who oversees this? In other words, you've done this reporting. This particular drug maker feels that their drug is safe. But who steps in and says, maybe we should change the way we test medications for animals? I mean, who's in charge?
Well, it would be Congress and the FDA who lay out the rules of the game of how drugs are tested and monitored, how they're sold, and whether or not they are ever withdrawn. The FDA lacks any kind of mandatory authority to recall an unsafe or even a safe drug from the market. It can only issue a warning to the public and to the company and ask them to withdraw a drug.
Yeah, well, this all comes at a time when the approval process for human drugs is slowing down somewhat. Are you seeing drug makers turn to pet meds because of that, and because there's money in it? We see the ads. Everybody knows how much Americans are loving their animals more and more.
That's true. And those are a couple of good points you raise. Yes, Lilly has been in mostly the human side for its 136 years. They've lost patents on three big drugs. They've gone through numerous stages of layoffs. Less than 10 years ago, they started getting into pet medicines. They saw this as an area with lots of promise, with much quicker turnaround, cheaper development costs, and the pressure is on them. And they've made no secret that they want to launch several new pet drugs to help the company get over this rough spot.
Yeah. Well, and then you also talk about the relationship between veterinarians, some veterinarians, and these drug companies.
the same questions are raised about human doctors, are who's being paid, you know, to tout, or maybe not being paid, but taken out to dinner quite a bit, you know, to tout a certain medication. You find that relationship in some places in the animal world.
The difference is that you can find out if your doctor is getting money from a drug company. Every drug maker is now required to report every dollar they pay to a doctor for research, for speaking fees, for continuing education. There's no similar requirement for veterinarians, and we've asked almost every major drug company to provide us a list. They say we don't have to. We're not going to.
Look, we all know that there are also veterinarians who are angels, who have helped many of us at very difficult times. But what you're describing is very troubling. You've been reporting for 30 years. Your sense of this story, you seem to have pulled a thread here. Your sense of this story.
I covered the human side of medicine for 5 years. It just boggled my mind how much secrecy there was, how little the experts out there, when I would talk to them, seemed to know about this world. This industry flies much lower under the radar.
Well, your first line of part one of your three-part series is, Harry, Sesame, Ramsey, Colby, Rocky, and Peaches have something in common. All of these beloved pets were prescribed a new chewable flea and heartworm medicine, and now they're all dead. What are people saying to you, and what would you say to pet owners who are now saying, well, what should I do?
Yes, that's a good question, because I've gotten that question much. What medicine should I take? Is Trifexa dangerous or is it safe? And I can't give an answer. I think the point of our series was there needs to be a lot more openness, a lot more transparency, a lot less shadows about who's getting the money, about how many dogs are being tested. So I can't really say that the drug is safe or what one people should take. All I can say is make the system a lot more accessible and open.
John Russell, investigative reporter for the Indianapolis Star. We'll link you to his reporting at hereandnow.org. John, thank you.
Thanks a million.
And I don't know about you, but I can barely load a YouTube video these days without watching an ad first. So perhaps it's no surprise that spending on advertising in the U.S. jumped this year by more than 5% to roughly $180 billion. And for advertising professors, maybe that's a good thing. Lots to look back on. Joining us to look at some of the best ad campaigns of 2014 is Here and Now media analyst and Boston University communications professor John Carroll. John, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
So what are the criteria that you're using here to determine the best ads?
Well, a couple of things. Impact in terms of financial results, impact in terms of social media, of news coverage. This is a mix of TV spots and webvertising, because a lot of marketers now are going on the web very effectively and using that as a medium for their advertising. So it's a mix of the two.
So you brought us your top five.
Right, right. Guaranteed to generate 100% disagreement among our listeners. I think that this is a mix of different ads that really stood out to me this year. Let's start with this one from Guinness. It actually launched last fall, but it's a sort of a mugwump ad. It's gotten a lot of press this year. It shows a half a dozen guys playing wheelchair basketball. They spin, they scoot, they shoot, they knock each other over, and then you hear this voiceover.
Dedication. Loyalty.
I'm getting better at this. Yeah. Next week, buddy.
So then five of the six get out of their wheelchairs and walk toward the exit with the one who is still in his wheelchair who can't get out of it. It's a really terrific ad with the sort of surprise ending.
Why? What's so great about it?
I think it's a misdirection ad. You think that these are six guys who have to be in a wheelchair, and the truth is that five of them are getting in wheelchairs to sort of level the playing field.
Okay, so Guinness, a winner there. You've got another one called World's Toughest Job, which features snippets of webcam interviews for the position of director of operations. Here's a clip.
First category for the requirements would be mobility. This job requires that you must be able to work 135 hours to unlimited hours a week. It's basically 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
I'm sure you'll have a chance from time to time to maybe just sit down here and there, yeah?
You mean like a break?
Yeah.
No, there are no breaks available.
So what's so great about that one?
The ad agency posted a help wanted ad for director of operations job. And these are real interviews for a fake job. And in the end, it turns out that the job, the director of operations, is mom. And this is for American Greetings card stores.
Uh-huh. And this one did pretty well online.
It did very well. It got a lot of press, and it also got about 22 million views on YouTube, which is a pretty good hit.
All right. Well, this next ad got more than twice that many views on YouTube. Tell us about this one.
This one employs the popular 1 second a day format. And it starts out with a young girl, average girl who's at a birthday party. She's at music lessons. She goes to school. And then all of a sudden, it all goes wrong. The girl winds up in a gas mask at a refugee camp, and then a super comes on the screen and says, just because it isn't happening here doesn't mean it isn't happening. Save serious children. It's a really effective ad and raised about $100,000.
And who put that out?
Save the Children, an organization that goes and does philanthropic work, rescue work around the world.
Well, this next ad that you brought us is actually also from a nonprofit, and I doubt that there's a single listener who is hearing this right now who has not seen this in some form or another. I'm talking about the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge. Yes, that happened in 2014. It generated $100 million for the ALS Foundation that's working to find a cure for Lou Gehrig's disease. And of course, people just did this all over the place. They poured ice cold water on their heads for a good cause, but they also made an ad.
Yeah, this is one for the books because basically they used a combination of news media, social media, and marketing on the web to make this a real phenomenon, a total cultural phenomenon. Here's just one of the videos that's up on YouTube. It features 38 celebrities, including Taylor Swift and actress model Jamie King.
We're not just casually holding all these $100 bills. We're actually going to put our money where our mouths are, and every single person you see here, we're going to donate on their behalf $100.
3, 2, 1!
And John, this is really where webvertising worked this year, where an online campaign actually raised money.
Yeah, this ripple effect was really amazing. Essentially, it was this small bore kind of campaign, and all of a sudden, people started sending it out on social media, and it was all over the place. So you had all kinds of celebrities, Eminem, Oprah Winfrey, Justin Timberlake. There were all kinds of people who were engaged in this. And interestingly, not too long ago, Samuel L. Jackson used this as sort of a springboard for another campaign, said, you know, I want people to go out and sing this song that's a protest. All you ice bucket celebrities, go out and sing a song that's a protest against police brutality. Trying to springboard off it, I'm not sure it's going to get the same amount of traction.
We shall see. And finally, we've got number five here, the ad campaign that revolved around an ad that didn't get made.
Yeah, Newcastle Ale has about a $2 million annual budget. That's about half of what you need to buy 30 seconds on the Super Bowl. So they built this campaign called If We Made It. And essentially what they did was create all this different content. They have somebody showing the storyboard of the ad that they would have made if they had the money. And then they have indie actress Anna Kendrick, who was the actress who would have been in the Super Bowl ad if they had made it, but they didn't.
I was really excited to make a commercial with Newcastle, but then turns out they don't even have the money or permission to make a commercial. They can't even say the word it's bleeped.
So it's very funny, and she goes on for about 2 minutes, and it's worth watching the whole thing just for the ending, which is a real hoot. So Newcastle got 600 media stories about this.
Wow!
They say they got 1 billion impressions. They say they had a high triple-digit lift in sales. I'm not even sure what that means. That could mean they sold 599 more six-packs. But it certainly got a lot of attention for an ad that didn't get made.
John, in the year of 2014, in the world of advertising, was this a big game changer of a year? Is advertising markedly different now than it was a year ago? Or what's going on Madison Avenue and around the country?
I think it's an evolution. It's sort of a slow development of these alternative platforms. I mean, you're seeing a lot of mobile advertising,
yeah.
and it's a real tricky thing because people don't really want you jumping on their smartphone. It feels more intrusive, actually, on your smartphone than in many other areas. But they're trying to figure out, you know, what's the best way to reach people, and it's a real combination now. The marketer's dream has always been to advertise to an audience of one. And that's what they're looking to do. And more they're using these digital vehicles to try to hone in on particular consumers with particular pitches.
And are the fundamentals the same? Is the content the same and they're just having to figure out a different way to get it to you? Or is the very core of advertising changing?
No, the process is different. It used to be branding was all about what the marketer wanted to communicate, who they wanted to communicate to, and how they wanted to communicate. Now, it's more of a collaboration. It's this sort of participatory kind of branding where you get into a conversation with people that's in a brand community. So to go out and to just deliver messages in the old sort of one-way transmitter-receiver kind of process, that doesn't really work as much anymore. It's still there, and television's never going to go away. Television advertising is never going to go away. But more and more, there are these supplemental channels that marketers can use to have a different kind of conversation with the consumer. And it's a real shift in the balance of power. The consumer has a lot more power now than they did before, and marketers are slowly waking up to that.
John Carroll, Here and Now media analyst and a mass communication professor at Boston University, and we've got a link to his Campaign Outsider blog at our website, hereandnow.org. John, thanks.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.